Venture through a wasteland twisted by dark magic, undead monsters, and contagious insanity where life and death are no longer opposites, but a spectrum of cruelties. Emerging from the dregs, an old king makes one final attempt to save his realm. Today's episode is brought to you by the newest project of Lee Ellis, author of the Killdash series, Godblood. Is a grim, dark short story with the audio runtime of 2 hours available on Audible and a digital print available for those that prefer reading. This exciting adventure is available now. But parents beware, it's not for the faint of heart. Stay tuned after the episode for an exclusive audio clip of Godblood. This is the Nerdy Old Men Podcast. Recognized by City View Magazine as best of the best in podcasts. And here are your hosts, the old bald man Chad and Redneck Wes. Hey, Wes, good morning.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah, I understand, and everybody can hear that Wes is mobile or remote, rather, because one of his spawn is ill today, so...
Yeah, so good, I'm running on like 30 minutes of sleep. So.
Good thoughts out to the little one there. Wes, introduce our special guest.
Our buddy Dan Gottlieb, who is an author, artist, and Doctor Who connoisseur.
Subject matter expert, as I'd like to say.
Yes, he is. Dan's been on the show with us before, but we were talking, and he's going to enlighten us because Chad... You and I, neither one really know a lot about Doctor Who, so...
No, and it is a gigantic fandom that the Nerdy Old Men podcast needs to explore. So, hey, Dan, first, how's it going, buddy? You doing all right?
Yeah, you know, getting by, you know, taking care of stuff, working on my second book. Nice. Which is equal to I Am Omega, which is I Am Omega, The Archangel War.
Yes.
I am also presently working on a children's book.
Oh, really? So, oh, that'll be cool.
He is a busy man.
He hustles. It's good. Now, you know, we are fans of your work, and we've talked to you about I Am Omega before. As a matter of fact, it's sitting up here on my shelf. I can see it right now. And
I appreciate
so,
that.
Yeah. So before we get into the Doctor Who, tell folks how they can find your work.
Well, I do have a website which is listed at www.theartofdangottlieb.com, or you can order a copy of I Am Omega on Amazon. Currently, just look up I Am Omega, unfortunately, the entire name, the beginning of the end.
Yes.
Preferably with the author's name, my name, Dan Gottlieb, so it'll basically pop up pretty quick.
Great. Well, good deal. So we'll put a link to that. So.
Thank you.
Well, tell us what got you into Doctor Who first, and then kind of educate me and Wes as if we don't know anything, because we don't. So
sure. So betraying my age, I actually was a child watching a lot of TV with my dad, a lot of sci-fi. My mother and my father used to work on a show called The Star Trek Review with Alan Ashman many, many moons ago. Cool. And they actually interviewed a great deal of, you know, the Star Trek cast and whatnot. And it was a cool kind of life to be in, because I would occasionally see flashes of cool things that would come through the sci-fi genre because of that. And my mother and my father, while we weren't particularly close, me and my dad, we would bond over watching certain types of sci-fi. And he researched and found Doctor Who on, I believe it was LJN at the time, which was one of these random TV networks that was like off the fringe. You couldn't really find Doctor Who.
Right.
It was more British, you know, British institution. Yeah. So we found a silly, curly-haired man with a long scarf running from a giant swamp creature, which, you know, scared the bejesus out of me back then. Looking back on it now, it's quite ridiculous. But that was the hook that drew you in. It evoked that sense of wonder. And next thing you know, this curly-haired man was injured to the point of death, where he regenerated into a different person. And then I realized this was something special, and how, you know, Doctor Who was this guy who had traveled through time and space, fighting evil, and essentially changing whenever his body is damaged beyond repair into a different character, where it would reinvigorate and rejuvenate the show. And I was hooked. I was watching all the way up until the seventh Doctor at the time, which was Sylvester McCoy. And unfortunately, there was no more episodes after that. It reached its 26th year.
Wow.
And there was no more. You know, it was all gone. So I always, you know, had a fondness in my heart for it. I always found myself referring to media, watching older episodes, realizing there was more Doctors prior to that curly-haired man. Right. Tom Baker, by the way, the actor. And, became a lifelong fan, and I know pretty much everything about it.
I mean, I know that it is a gigantic fandom. I mean, right up there with all the other big stuff. And but I know predominantly, it is a British thing. And I guess in the United States it's pretty popular too. But kind of give us the premise. And you said you're a good historian of it, so you know, read us in.
Okay. Well, the show started in 1963. Literally. Right around the time where Kennedy was shot. And that actually made a big difference for the show, because you had this old man who traveled with his granddaughter and basically stole two school teachers to come with him on adventures, not necessarily of their choice at the time. And the first episode did poorly because of the Kennedy assassination. Nobody watched it because everybody was watching, you know, what happened. It's a tragedy. And so they had the foresight to air it again after, you know, unfortunately the circumstances had passed, and then released something that was very different, which was you have this old man traveling through time and space, and they weren't sure if they were, you know, it was supposed to be like an educational program for children, which, you know, a lot of people back then, they had this rating system, they had a ratings box in their TVs. Parents didn't want to watch it because they wanted to watch, you know, the football game or whatever it was. And so the second episode is what made Doctor Who take off. And that was, they referred to it at the time as the Lonely Planet, but actually it was about the Daleks, which is the Doctor Who. If anybody knows Doctor Who, the Daleks was the lead villain that would scream at you, you know, exterminate, you know.
Yeah.
And they were giant pepper pots, they referred to it out there. It was like salt and pepper shakers. And nobody's seen anything like that on TV before. The episode got 10 million views, which was extremely high. London TV, and also they had a hit on their hands, and they continued forward. After that, the lead actor, which at the time was William Hartnell, he was the first Doctor, he got very ill during the course of him shooting in the last 3 years, and he wasn't able to retain his lines and wasn't able to do the job as expected. So they came across this idea, which wasn't called regeneration at the time, they just called it renewal, or he basically, since he was an alien, found a way that he became close to death, and he regenerated into the second Doctor, which, why is his name falling out of my head right now? essentially, when he became the second Doctor, he was rejuvenated, he was a younger man, he had a bowl cut, he looked kind of like he was an offshoot of the Beatles, like their old uncle. they realized that they could rejuvenate and restore the show every time the Doctor had died. So it's kind of like you see what this character's, you know, epic tales were like, traveling in time and space, educating kids, going, you know, facing all these different creatures and whatnot. The only downside was that budgeting. Because it was considered a children's show, they never really spent any real money on it. So there are times that you really have to suspend disbelief to believe what's there. But luckily, the lead actors that all came on, like when it came to the third Doctor, John Pertwee, you know, every actor took it very seriously. So you could tell that they loved what they did. You know, you got a sense of that character. You got a sense of the world they were building, even though the sets wobbled sometimes, which they did. they literally, you know, they made it work. The second Doctor was Patrick Troughton, by the way. Sorry about that. So, you know, then we get to Tom Baker, which had reached the all-time high, which everybody knows about the curls and the scarf. He had a perpetually long scarf that got stuck in things, and he used it all the time. He was the longest-serving Doctor. Then you went on to the fifth Doctor, which is Peter Davison. That was during the 80s. And then the sixth Doctor, Colin Baker, which everybody knows who the sixth Doctor is because his jacket was so bright and so crazy. It was a true reflection of the era it came from, which was quite would make you nauseous if you were to look at it too long. the seventh Doctor, Sylvester McCoy, was the last Doctor serving, and that's when the ratings started taking a real big dip. Michael Grade, who ran the BBC at the time, got fed up, decided he was done with the wobbly sets, and realized he wanted to give it a rest. They tried canceling it once during the Sixth Doctor's tenure. It didn't work because the fandom was so strong. But at the time of the Seventh Doctor, they had reached their 25th anniversary, and people were just not tuning in anymore. In fact, they barely got 4 million views at that, you know, and anything below 8 million or whatever was not considered worth being on TV back then. So Doctor Who took a long break. Literally, at their 26th year, they were considered canceled or on break. They were expected to come back. In fact, I had the pleasure of speaking to Sylvester McCoy in person recently.
Oh, wow.
And he told me, says that he originally was signed for 3 years, and that he could conceivably come back for a fourth year should it come back. But they already destroyed part of his sets, and they already, you know, he really didn't know what was going on. So he just kind of was going with the flow, and then he realized it was over, you know. So Doctor Who never died, though. It went on with media, it went on with books, it went on with, you know, serials. So there's the Doctor Who magazine. It would not die, you know, as much as these corporate guys wanted it to die off because they were tired of it.
Right.
It kept going. So they reached an agreement with an American company to make a movie, the 1996 Doctor Who movie, which featured Paul McGann as the Eighth Doctor. But they decided they wanted to have continuance from the old series, so they asked us to come in and regenerate into this new Doctor, which, and a lot of people in hindsight think was a bad idea because, you know, you're tying to something that some people had no idea what he was tied to, and you didn't have a fresh story where people could get excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of good ideas, and again, Paul McGann was a fantastic actor. He loved doing the movie, but it didn't take off. It didn't get good ratings in the United States. In London, it did really well. In UK, it did fine, but it just wasn't enough to keep it going. So it went back to bed, and it stayed there until 2005. Russell T. Davies had an idea to bring it back. The difference was he needed an actor with real gravitas, which is why he casted Christopher Eccleston. Christopher Eccleston was in a number of different plays. He was in the film he was in. It was where he played a second form of Jesus at one point. He's a fantastic actor. And to get him was a huge get. And he came on as the Ninth Doctor. And when he came on hard. Like, when the show came back, he came back with a theatrical score. And even though in 2005 the effects were considered dated, it was still beautiful. It was great to see it back. It had the energy that everybody wanted again. It had that sense of wonder, the sci-fi element. It wasn't preachy. It was one of those things that basically you get lost. Every time the Doctor would go away somewhere, you would get lost in where he went. You know, the second episode has 2 billion, you know, and the episode after that, the 1800s, you know, where he's meeting historical figures again. It was fun, you know?
Huh.
That's so cool.
Kind of, I'm sorry, Chad, I didn't mean to interrupt
you.
No,
go ahead. I'm just saying that's cool, just how they do it.
Yeah.
But continue through the history of them, because this is neat.
Yeah, so we get to the end of Christopher Eccleston's tenure, which you find out behind the scenes he wasn't too happy, because people don't realize how hard it is to put a show like that together. If you think about that, every episode, which there was, you know, only a few episodes each season, you know, maybe 10 to 12, depending on the season, 13 if there's a special, these guys are being worked 9 months out of the year really hard to shoot scenes all over the place, all different scenes, all different places in the world, all different times. And so Eccleston, which while we don't know the exact reason, he left after 1 year and had enough. And he was replaced by fan favorite David Tennant, who is the 10th Doctor and recently became the 14th Doctor once again. So David Tennant took the show to new heights. Again, the effects were not amazing, but they were good enough that people, again, could have that sense of wonder and disbelief about the character. And he stayed on for a while until 2010, which then the United States started to grasp the concept of making it more commercial here as well. And Matt Smith became the 11th Doctor, which it was reaching heights you wouldn't even believe. Like, they were getting people, American actors, to join the team. You know, it was just one of these things where the show was just reaching this amazing heights of glory. And it reached its 50th anniversary during this time.
Wow.
Which all doctors were celebrated in the 50th anniversary. And it was revealed that the Doctor had a secret doctor as well that nobody knew about, which was John Hurt as the War Doctor. Because it's revealed during the course of the time that the Doctor has been kind of running, is that he ran from a war. And so the war he ran from, he was a different persona where he wasn't the doctor. He was another person. And he, you know, he's running from that, but he, in the episode, he makes his peace with that and moves forward. And so subsequently, there was a few other doctors afterward, Peter Capaldi, fantastic actor. But again, the show is starting to go down again because after it's reached this all-time high, to keep it going that high, you have to keep on, you know, topping yourself.
Right.
And while Capaldi was fantastic and he had some amazing episodes, the writing was questionable. You know, he's the 12th doctor. And then the first female doctor ever took form, and that was the 13th doctor, Jodie Whittaker. And everybody was very excited about this. Because again, it's a big change for the show. And as I said, you have to kind of top what you did. But, you know, and this is my opinion, it lost steam pretty quick because it seemed more like a gimmick than it was actually something exciting.
Oh, they didn't put much into the story. They just were hoping that to change the gender might boost the show again.
Maybe. I mean, Jodie Whittaker is a capable actress. But the material she was doing.
Yeah, I mean, you can be a great actor, but if they write garbage for you, it's not going to be too good, you know?
Yeah, and that was the problem, because unfortunately, the stuff she was getting was really rough, and it was more about her breaking the glass ceiling, which, you know, I'm not going to get into the politics of it, but it ultimately took the show in the wrong direction. It became more preachier than it did a show about having fun, getting lost in adventures.
Right, and that's not good. That's not good for the actress. You know, I mean, that's not good. You know, could do a good job with the writing. Anyway, carry on.
And so to end that with is that at the end of her tenure, as I mentioned, David Tennant came back as the 14th Doctor, and some would say that he was brought back to kind of save the show, and others would say that it was a way to kind of celebrate the 60th anniversary of the show. But after watching them, which I'll go into later, neither is kind of what happened. So it was a nice idea, but now they're already on to the 15th Doctor, which is Shruti Gatwa, who seems to be a very talented actor, and I wish him the best, but who knows? Who knows what the future will bring with the show?
Right. So, I mean, that's a great history of the actors that have played it. So let's go into like, you mentioned a little bit, but the mythos of Doctor Who. So what is the premise behind it? I do think it's a fascinating way to keep the story going when one sort of dies, you know, quote unquote dies off, that they just regen into a brand new thing. I think that's a great way to reset the story sort of. So what about the mythos of the Doctor, and what's their mission? How did they come about? Explain the antagonist of the story and everything like that.
Well, here's where it gets a little weird, because initially the idea of the character is that he's a highborn Time Lord who did not want to live on his planet Gallifrey.
Okay.
And he ran away. He stole a TARDIS, which is a time and relative dimensions in space device, a time machine, and ran away with his granddaughter at the time. And from there on in, he realized he was more at home in space, helping others and doing what he can to, you know, do what's right versus being a Time Lord.
Okay.
And, you know, that ultimately is the concept. You know, he's a wandering traveler who makes the best of every situation when he appears. There have been other concepts that have been explored with the character, of course, that sometimes being a time traveler means he has too much power. But they've also established that there are fixed points of time that he can't disrupt, and he has to let them play out. It's a cool concept because, again, you know, having a show where you could be anywhere, anytime, any place is pretty amazing. You know, there's a lot of that that's explored. Unfortunately, with the Jodie Whittaker run, the 13th Doctor I was telling you about, they made it a little less exciting because now they made it where he can regenerate indefinitely versus having a limitation of how many times he can regenerate, he or she can regenerate. I don't know. There's a lot of things where they say he's not even really a Time Lord. He's not really from Gallifrey. All that's a lie, you know, and you know, they supposedly want to make that an exciting new plot point, which divided the canon.
Well, you know, any kind of fandom will just go nuts, especially if you change too much of something. So, yeah, that's difficult for them to deal with on that. So, basically, he escaped from where he was from, And he's just exploring, traveling. It's not like a quantum leap type kind of thing where he's always trying to change what once went wrong kind of a deal. He's just exploring.
Well, he's not forced to be part of events unless, as I said, there are those fixed points of time where he realizes he's part of those events and he doesn't even know it afterwards.
Okay.
You know, which is kind of, there's been a few times where he goes, oh, well, you know, why am I here? I don't even, oh, wait a minute. And he realizes he's been manipulated to do it for the side of the Time Lords, you know, which is kind of cool. He'll even yell at the sky, like, why did you do this to me? You know?
Right.
But that was the cool thing about the show is that he just didn't need to get away. He wanted to escape everything. And he realized that's where his home is, traveling.
That's pretty cool. So what about the antagonist? You said the salt and pepper shaker looking, messed up on crack R2-D2 looking things.
Yes. Well, that's a very colorful analogy, but yes. ultimately the Daleks are an analogy for the Nazis. They literally are hate-filled creatures they had to make these travel devices because their bodies mutated. And they were originally called Tigris.
Oh, so there's creatures inside those machines or those capsules.
Correct.
Oh, okay, correct. Okay.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either. I thought it was like a robot race, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, a lot of people thought they were. In fact, it was initially the idea, even though they showed creatures from time to time, it was this sort of this conflict that there's robot aspects of it, but there's still a creature, this blob inside of those arms that has one eye driving the thing, driving it with hate. And, you know, it's a cool concept in theory and how they did it, where it's just their only goal is to exterminate anything that is not like them.
Wow.
So,
okay.
Know.
Yeah. Now yeah. I see. Yeah. I see where they're playing on that. Yeah.
But there have been other major villains in the shows that have been iconic. The Cybermen, who are basically human 2.0. They think that they need to upgrade humans to be cybernetic. You know, they play upon the fears of AI, which looks like it's happening more and more. you know, you have the Master, who is a renegade Time Lord who essentially has some sort of grievance with the Doctor, which has been explored. You know, and the Master keeps destroying his body over and over again, you know, so he keeps regenerating to something else as well. You know, there's many other iconic villains in the show that the Doctor has encountered or has to face again.
Okay. Dang. I was wondering how they could go that many years with having basically the same antagonist. I mean, I guess the Daleks pop back in periodically to make sure, you know, because I guess they're the overall bad guy, right?
Yeah, I mean, whenever you want to, like when they brought the show back in 2005, the first thing to let people know this is Doctor Who is the Daleks had to appear. And that's all there is to it. But, you know, they don't necessarily dominate every storyline, but they are a very strong portion of it because they make a lot of sense for, you know, the Doctor to eventually face them down because they are his ultimate villain.
And are they out to stop him? Or are they
everything that's not like them?
Or okay, so yeah, I mean, so he's kind of there to stop them. They're they're not there just specifically to go after him, or at least not originally.
Well, initially, no. Initially, they meet him because he lands on their planet and finds out that they're, you know, the side effects of, you know, fallout on their planet that have been, they've reached the ultimate conclusion where they start bombing each other. And now these creatures are in travel devices to get around to try to, you know, kill anything different. But later on, when we get to that fourth Doctor again, he had an iconic story, which is considered one of the best stories of the classic era. It's called Genesis of the Daleks. And it reveals that there was an evil scientist named Davros who travels in a very similar device that looks like a Dalek bottom, like a wheelchair. And he ultimately, he's creating these devices as their future. And you realize the Doctor has a moment where he can actually destroy them. And he has that proof of conscience. Do I have the right to kill the entire race for the safety of the universe? You know, do I have the right? He has this power play, and his companions, his humans, the ones that make him understand that this is either right or wrong. You know, it's definitely worth a watch.
Right. So you said it originally aired as like a kid's show.
Yeah. And it still is considered mostly for kids. Again, it's science fiction. It deals with time travel. It deals with all these elements that kids can definitely get excited about which, you know, me as a kid, I loved it because it was scary, it was fun, it was exciting. It took you to different places. You know, it fueled my imagination for me to want to be creative and draw. And you could say that even the little logo I've done for Iron Omega is a homage to the intros of Doctor Who.
Right. Yeah, I can see that now. Yeah. I'm looking at the book. Yeah. So this is a hard question for you, probably, as being a big super fan. But, you know, what? Maybe rank your top five doctors.
Rank myself five doctors?
Yeah, rank your top five doctors. Which ones? Okay. Yeah, like 5 to 1.
Well, if I were to go backwards from five to one being the best, let me see. My fifth favorite, believe it or not, is the sixth doctor, because the sixth doctor was a guy who, unfortunately, as I mentioned, got a really disastrous costume, but he acted the hell out of it. And he still, you know, he told people, he made a joke where he said, "At least I didn't have to see it. Everybody else did." you know, but his drive, his passion for the character, you could tell it screamed at people that this guy loved the show. And he got a short end of the stick. You know, he really didn't get a fair run of it.
Right.
He even has a very iconic series called The Trial of a Time Lord, where he's put on trial for supposedly crimes he's committed against everything in existence and how he's, you know, responsible for genocide. And, but he meets a evil future version of himself called the Valyard, which was fascinating, you know, and really great stuff, you know?
Yeah.
My fourth favorite doctor would probably be Peter Capaldi, the 12th doctor. Again, his material could have been better, but you could see he was serious about it. In fact, there's a funny story is that he actually was the head of the Doctor Who fan club when he was a child, and to become a doctor himself.
Oh,
it's a pretty amazing.
Cool.
That's neat.
Oh,
yeah.
That's cool.
You know, it was even revealed that he wrote in complaining about one of the episodes, and they threw it in his face.
And they didn't hold it against him. That's good.
Yeah. And he was also one of the older actors in the more modern era to play the Doctor. He was 55 when he came on versus all these younger, you know, versions of the Doctor that all the girls would swoon over, you know. the third favorite for me would be Peter Davison, the fifth Doctor, mostly because even though I started with Tom Baker, I kind of grew up watching the entire series of the fifth Doctor. He was like an older brother to everybody. He was always breathless and always about the adventure. And his last episode, The Caves of Androzani, was directed a lot like the modern era of Doctor Who. It had a lot of energy. You could see it. He was taunting his villains. You know, he was really going at it before he unfortunately dies and regenerates into the sixth Doctor. So, a lot of good stuff there. My second to last is Matt Smith. Matt Smith is the 11th Doctor. He was a younger, and to be honest, when I first saw him, I didn't like him very much. I thought he kind of missed the mark. But then I saw his first story, which is a great jumping on point for everybody, called The 11th Hour, where the first time the Doctor regenerates into a new body and meets a young girl named Amy Pond, Amelia Pond, she's known as, and the first thing he says is he's hungry, and she tries to make him food, and he's literally spitting everything out in front of her, and she's looking at him like he's crazy. He goes, "Sorry, it's a new mouth. New rules."
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it's extremely, you endear to this Doctor pretty quickly after that, because he realized that you're part of that discovery process with him, and everybody loves that. You know, everybody loves someone you can, you know, fall in love with together type of thing, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my last favorite is, you know, the number one is Christopher Eccleston. And even though he had a short tenure, he is the guy that brought this show back. He is the guy. I mean, he literally came on board, and even though he had Earthbound episodes, and even though his effects probably weren't the strongest, this guy came in and gave it a certain level of gravitas that made the character stand out and make everybody take notice. And that's the reason why we have a modern era of Doctor Who. It's because of this guy. You know, you believe him. He would go from moments of reflection where he'd be upset about the war that he'd been through. And then you have moments where he is, you know, jovial and friendly and kind, whimsical. He did it all. He was amazing.
That's cool. I thought not that you'd probably go with, I guess, everybody's David Tennant or maybe Hartnell, the first one. But
well, you know, the thing is that when it comes to David Tennant, there's nothing wrong with him. I just think that a lot of his lines were holier than thou. Like the guy was preaching a lot.
Right.
No, I'm a Time Lord. I'm 906 years old. I'm this. Who cares? You know, I understand that's serial, but I didn't believe him, you know, and that's the problem. Later on, he got better with it, but, you know, a little too much, you know, speeches, you know, that type of stuff never really gets anybody too excited.
Yeah, you know? It's sci-fi. It needs to be fun. Yeah. Yeah.
I figured your top one would be Matt Smith, just because I was at a convention one year that he was at, and everyone was dressed as Doctor Who, and I'm assuming his version of Doctor Who. And the venue we were at had an overlook where the celebrities were having lunch at. And he comes up to the window and waves, and like the entire convention just like shut down. And everyone turned in his way, and he just standing there smiling and waving at people. And like the whole floor like stopped. And I was like, wow, these Doctor Who fans are, you know, they're serious about this guy. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't watched the show, so I recognized him just everyone carrying his picture around, but it was crazy the amount of love that they had for that character that he played. I thought that was really neat.
He's also an exceptional actor. You know, he was in the Game of Thrones spinoff, and he was just absolutely amazing in that. And you don't look at him like, oh, it's the guy who plays Doctor Who. No, you looked at him as, you know, one of the Targaryens, and he was brutal. You know, when he was in, as silly as it was, Morbius, as Morbius' brother, and he did that dance where he's being a vampire, he was the best part of the damn film, which isn't saying much. You know? He was also in The Crown, where he played Prince Henry, I believe. Forgive me, I didn't see it, but I know that I saw a bit of him in it, and he was exceptional. So, you know, he's a versatile actor who enjoys everything about what he did with Doctor Who, and you can tell.
That's awesome, though. That's really cool. I mean, yeah. I still get hung up on the fact that because I pulled up something here on the computer about when you started talking about 1963 to the present day, except for a gap time there. I mean, they must be
the wilderness years. They must,
the wilderness years. Okay. Cause where he just disappears. Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like to keep something going that long with generation, I mean, that's generational fan base. That's pretty mm-hmm. good. That's pretty good stuff.
Some people would say that regeneration saved the show right. Because having there be a new lead, new companions, new venues, but still ultimately the same person deep down, you know, pulling from the pool of memories that this person has when they travel, you know, it's a great way to keep the show going and refreshes it. I think the only reason why it died is because there's a lack of faith. It kind of lost its way at times. And then, of course, at the end of the day, as much as people want to argue, it's always about writing. Whenever the writing starts to fail,
right.
The whole show will fail. And it did have some weak episodes, even though they were trying to turn it around with better writing as it went along, it just still wasn't enough. So it already kind of signed its death warrant at the time.
Right. Where do you watch the show? Where is it available? Where do you like to watch it at?
So recently, they have a new agreement with Disney Plus, the BBC. So you can watch on Disney Plus now. They have what they call the Hooniverse, which features all of the past episodes, all of the side shows like Sarah Jane Adventures, which is one of his companions who was very popular, and she got a spinoff. You know, there's a number of different shows that were tied to Doctor Who, which are all now on that platform. They have a new agreement. So it's currently being viewed there. Of course, if you live in the UK, you can watch it on the BBC, of course.
Right, right. Oh, that's cool. Where would you suggest somebody like me and Wes that haven't watched it? What would you suggest to start at? Yeah, would you start at the beginning?
Well, that's a hard answer. Yeah, it's a hard way to answer that because you know, a lot of people say that the initial jumping on point was 2005 with my favorite Doctor, the Christopher Eccleston years. But the thing is, if you want a really fresh perspective, you might be better off starting off with the 11th Doctor, which is that 11th hour with Amelia Pond, I was talking about, because it takes you through who the Doctor is.
Oh, okay.
You know, it tells you about, you know, what happened to him, and it's a great jumping on point. So there's a number of places, there's like placeholders when you can kind of jump in and say, oh, okay, because it always goes back to the history eventually, you know? So I'm a little torn between the two. There's either episode one, Rose, in 2005, or The 11th Hour with The 11th Doctor in 2010.
Right.
Both had their moments, but again, you have to forgive the effects, because the effects improved considerably during 2010.
Right. So jumping in that time frame is probably pretty good. And then, you know, if you enjoy the show, you could probably get nostalgic and go back further, right?
Well, the funny thing is that I love the fact that the old Doctor Who's are in black and white, because they give that sense of wonder again. I watched a second Doctor episode called The Time Meddler, which incidentally the character, the bad guy, was called the Master, even though he's not the Master in the show.
Right.
And it deals with the Doctor getting locked into storybooks, where he's dealing with fictional characters that are coming to life to come get him and his companions. And he's at one point, faces off against a Minotaur, and he has to believe that they don't exist. It's the only way he can push them away and stop them from attacking him or getting him. There's giant wooden soldiers attacking him, you know? And it's all done black and white, and it's done in such a way that you believe it.
That's cool, though.
You know? That's neat, though.
Well, you know, sometimes that old school sci-fi stuff is really good. I mean, as a kid, I loved the original Star Trek, and I would get, mm-hmm. I would get VHS cassettes at the rental store and watch these old episodes of Star Trek. And just that old school sci-fi, it was fantastic.
Right. And I mean, the thing is that I'm one of these guys that loves doing research. So I watch all the documentaries that come with it as well. What brought them to this point? What gave them this concept of the story? And that same story, The Time Meddler, was quite fascinating, because even though they wanted to do it, they realized they ran out of money on the first episode. And they were like, what are we going to do? So they deliberately made the whole place white, like a null space. So the first part of the story, the first episode, deals with them dealing with these robots in this null space, and they're realizing they're passing through the regular universe into the fantasy verse that they're supposedly going to be, dealing with in the second episode, because that's where the money was.
Right, yes.
But that's an imaginative and creative way, find a workaround. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we get there? So,
exactly.
Production credit where it's due, that's pretty slick.
Yeah, money is always a concern. Budgeting is always a concern. You don't have these, unlike the old days, now where these big studios come in and they can just throw money at something, it's not a big deal. But I think it loses that creativity when you can't have the money and you have to figure something out. I think it's a really cool concept, to kind of work around it. And it literally, that episode was iconic, and it's considered one of the best episodes of that Doctor's era.
And it was just because they didn't have the money to do anything.
Correct.
Awesome.
They had a dead space. They said, all right, well, they're in the void. There's nothing there. We'll worry about it next episode.
The idea of, if you don't have special effects and big sets and things like that, you really got to rely on writing and acting.
Mm-hmm.
And there is something about that I think is underappreciated.
Patrick Troughton, just like any of the other doctors, could hold the camera on his own. In fact, there's a number of episodes where doctors, whenever they're alone without companions, you really get to see if they shine. The 12th Doctor did that in one of his episodes as well. I believe it's called Hellbent. He is literally trapped in a puzzle of his own making. And he's there all alone except for a creature that is walking after him. And it's coming because flies start appearing. And it literally is this veiled creature that follows him everywhere he goes unless he tells the truth, which the Doctor is known for lying. So it's a really cool concept, and he's all alone. And in fact, I highly recommend watching it because it really shows how good of an actor Peter Capaldi is.
Nice.
So there's a number of episodes like that.
That's great. One more thing I want to go over with it. This has been really cool, and now I'm interested in going and watching it. Is you always see him with some sort of device. What is that? What is that called? And what's the deal with that?
I don't know if you can hear it in the distance. That's the that's the sonic screwdriver.
Sonic screwdriver. All right.
Yeah, the Doctor. it was invented during the second Doctor's tenure back in '66. I'm going to say. Where it was just used occasionally for him to open up doors and whatnot. And then later on, it started evolving and it had him opening up other things. And eventually they realized it was a MacGuffin where you kind of open up anything. So later on, they had to kind of get rid of it during the Fifth Doctor's tenure and have it be destroyed temporarily. But then they brought it back. And, you know, then they had to create new reasons why it wouldn't work in stories. So this is deadlocked sealed. I can't get this open with even with the sonic screwdriver.
It's pretty cool, though.
Yeah, that's his device.
Nice. Yeah. Man, this has been a good educational session on Doctor Who, and I've wanted to watch it because, you know, I mean, I love sci-fi, and it's a, you know, it's a staple in science fiction. So I think I know where I need to start.
I think you're like me, though. It was a little intimidating because there was so much
of it. It's been around for so long,
It's like, where do I start? How do I get into it? Do I just jump in and just hope I figure stuff out, or...
Well, I mean, the thing is that I can give you the best answer I can give anybody, which is a lot of people always want to do things on their own. And when it comes to watching shows like this, this is a real experience. I got into this because I watched it with my dad. We bonded over that, you know, and like any show, like Supernatural, you know, I watched it with my ex-girlfriend. You know, it was like one of those things where I found that a lot of these shows are more enjoyable to be kind of going through this whole experience, these characters, these stories, these experiences with them. And it's something that brings people together.
Nice.
So I would say sit down one day, sit down with the wife and kids or whatever, and or with good friends, and just, you know, enjoy it as an experience, because that's exactly what it's supposed to be.
Nice. That's good. That's good advice. Well, before we go, Dan, hit us again with what's going on in your world. Where again, repeat where people can find your art and your work and where they can make contact with you.
So I, as I mentioned, I have a website called www.theartofdangottlieb.com. I can be found on Instagram as well, DanTheMan_official, where I usually feature a lot of my art and stuff I'm doing for trade shows and conventions, which this next year I don't have a schedule slated yet, but I do have a number of shows that I will be attending, and I will post those on my website as soon as I have them. I'm presently working on my second book, a sequel to my first book, I Am Omega, The Beginning of the End, which I wrote with Thomas Casparo. The second book is called I Am Omega, The Archangel War. Hopefully it should be done this year. I'm not going to get ahead of myself. I'm also working on a children's book as well. Otto the Otter Learns the Alphabet. Book can currently be found on Amazon. So if you just look up my name, Dan Gottlieb, and look up I Am Omega, The Beginning of the End, and keep track of my exploits
there. There we go. And we'll put it on the show information as well, the show description and all that, so everybody can get a taste of Dan and his stuff, because it's super fun. And we got to spend a lot of time together at Fanboy last year because you were a couple booths down from us. We had a great time, and we really appreciate you hanging out with us today and educating us on one of the principal topics in science fiction, which is Doctor Who. So, we appreciate that.
No, I'm happy to do it. And I'm a big supporter of the Nerdy Old Man podcast. You guys really have a lot of fun. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much, man. We love you and your stuff too, man. So go check out Dan's stuff. Click on the links in the show description, and we'll post some things up there, because you got to go check his stuff out, because it's fantastic. So, man, have fun up there in the big city. All right, we'll catch you guys later. So for Dan the Man and Redneck West, is the Old Bald Man Chad.
Yeah.
Now, a sample of Lee Ellis's Godblood.
Came up for Rogot's belly. He parried, elbowed Garagot in the teeth, then slammed him into a tree. Through the tree, and out the other side, and into the dirt. Splinters fell all around, and the severed tree came falling, crushing a giant mushroom to the earth. Garagot kicked Rogot, and he went soaring, flipped backwards and crashed down 20 paces away. The Mushroom King was up and after him. Rogot grabbed his axe, pulling up a handful of leaves with it, and leapt to his feet. Their weapons collided, and they were at it again, snarling, hacking, shoving and punching, god blood thumping in their veins. Garagot thrusted the flat side of his blade hard against Rogot's axe, pressed him back, then shoved a crust-covered finger deep into Rogot's ear.